So today we're here at the grand opening of the Canadian Canoe Museum, and it is incredibly exciting.
This is Victoria Grant, Anishinaabe Kwe from Temagami First Nation, and former chair of this place, the Canadian Canoe Museum.
I think storytelling is a part of this museum. I would argue that any story of the canoe is an Indigenous story. So this is a place where we can tell our stories, learn our history.
On May 12th, the Canadian Canoe Museum opened its doors in Peterborough, Ontario. It has the world's largest collection of canoes, kayaks, and watercraft, each carrying a story and a lesson.
I really believe a canoe has spirit. You need to get along. You need to agree to go the same way. You need to have balance so you can use it, much like the medicine wheel. People talk about it as a teaching tool. I think the canoe is every bit as much a teaching tool, and we can use it in so many ways.
Canoes and kayaks have been used by Indigenous peoples since time immemorial. They helped our ancestors travel the waterways of Turtle Island. These days, they still connect us to community, culture, and carry a piece of our past. Gantse Anin Buju, hello and welcome. This is Unreserved. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Canoes are synonymous with Canada, but Indigenous people were paddling around long before settlers sailed to our lands. Ian McCallum from the Munsee Delaware Nation took a canoe trip as a way to teach the Lenape language using the sights and sounds of the river.
We have the ability to learn a whole lot more about our people by taking a paddle or considering the river simply because those resources aren't readily accessible.
Michelle Robinson is from the Clahoose and Chemainuch Nations. She uses canoe journeys to build community and heal intergenerational trauma.
You see everybody that's different upbringings and different things going on, and then all of a sudden you're on a canoe, and so having to learn to paddle together is really, really important.
Mary Jane Prue works with the Canadian Canoe Museum. She's breaking traditional museum norms that deem canoe collections as objects of the past.
I treat the canoes as living beings, you know, and they tell their stories and histories, and they're more than just objects.
Today, we paddle across Turtle Island to learn how Indigenous people are using the canoe to carry on our stories.
So we're in like the central space of the exhibit hall, which is kind of our tribute to the lands and territories that we're situated on, which is Mississaugog Anishinaabe territory.
That's Mary Jane Prue, giving our producer Rhiannon Johnson a tour of the new Canadian Canoe Museum. The museum officially opened its doors earlier this spring in Peterborough, Ontario.
And can you describe this canoe to me that we have in front of us?
Yeah, so it's a rough water birch bark Mi'kmaq canoe, and it's actually not that old. It was just built in 2022 by Todd Labrador, Melissa Labrador, and their family. It's got etched bark, so the hands that you see etched into the bark represent all the people that helped make it, and it's got that on the stern as well. And it's all organic material, so it's got ribs and planking. This is all spruce root that lashes all of the people pieces together underneath the gunwales.
This Mi'kmaq canoe is just one of the many watercraft here. Mary Jane says learning their stories has opened a world of cultural connection she never expected. Museums have a tenuous relationship with Indigenous communities. Too often they've been responsible for extracting or artifacts and cultural items. But the Canoe Museum aims to do things differently. Rather than extract, they want to build relationships and instill trust within Indigenous communities. Mary Jane is the Indigenous Projects Coordinator at the Canadian Canoe Museum. For her, canoes and kayaks are more than just objects. They have their own spirit and carry important stories.
The canoe, I guess, has several different roles, but if you look at the amount of fresh water in Canada and the canoe just at its basis as a mode of transportation, it makes sense that before you had railways and roads, the canoe was used to navigate, because you can pretty much paddle across Canada in a canoe with very limited portages, or at least smaller ones than anywhere else in the world. So my mom's side of the family is Anishinaabe, and then my biological father's side of the family is Scottish and settler. And it was really the first museum or place that I came into and felt like proud to be Anishinaabe, which is why I kind of stuck with it. But the canoe for me has changed over my time with the museum. I didn't grow up out on the water much. I grew up very much in like an urban environment. So even just to be exposed to paddling later on in life just exposed me to this whole new world and connection with the natural environment that I didn't really feel growing up. And then a connection to culture as well. I think the canoe has like an evolving role in the history of Canada, with some more difficult stories. I treat the canoes as living beings, you know, and they tell their stories and histories, and they're more than just objects. They were made to be used and out on the water, and now they're resting, and they can share those stories with other people. So there's a way to care for their spirit as much as their physical preservation. Traditional care practices have been part of the museum long before like I even started with the museum, having local nations come in to do ceremony and care for the canoes in a more of a spiritual or a cultural way should be just as important as their physical preservation. So even having a smudge for the canoes to let them know it's time to rest until we can bring you to your new space, and then having a smudge when they get here and letting them know people are coming in, you can wake up now, and you know. Yeah, that's been pretty cool. And then last week we also had an elder in to do a smudge with the collection before even just having people in here too, and like preparing the space in a good way. So I've been lucky enough to be part of that and kind of quietly learning and watching, and I'm hoping to develop a traditional care policy too. So we practice like Anishinaabe traditional care, but some of the collection comes from, you know, across Turtle Island, so it would be good to incorporate different traditional care practices based on their place of origin, whether that's local medicines being kept with the canoe, and this is specific to the Indigenous collections, but I think it's just gonna grow and people are gonna learn and be open, and yeah, it's a good space. It feels good. Museums have a very colonial history, and especially Indigenous collections really just started off as like a craze of private collectors. So telling authentic stories sometimes means like standing back and giving people space to tell their own stories. And I feel like throughout the exhibit development process and having a new museum, we really had the opportunity to do that in a way that I haven't really seen in many other museums growing up. So that's been pretty cool. We have a responsibility to share the stories that the collection tells, and more so than physically preserving artifacts, it's about preserving stories and histories. And this is probably our most chronological zone. So it starts like prior to European contact and then ends right up to today, and this area talks about some of the more difficult stories with the canoe at the center of it. So after the implementation of the Indian Act, surveying by canoe, resource extraction by canoe, because you know the use of railways and highways, like the waterways were the highways, so a lot of mapping was done by canoe, and that eventually led to the removal of Indigenous people from their traditional territories. So the canoe can also be a tool used for some more difficult stories and relationship telling, and this space doesn't shy away from that. This kayak is special to me. This watercraft is from around 1897 and belonged to a gentleman named Minnick Wallace, who was Greenlandic Inuit. Robert Peary, in 1896, he's known as like the explorer that was the first man that went to the North Pole. And during that time, there was like a collection craze where indigenous objects were being taken from communities. At the same time, assimilating regulations were put in place to ban things like ceremony, among many other things. And so Minnick was brought back on one of these expeditions to Greenland, along with many different objects, and we're still trying to retrace kind of the journey of this kayak. He was brought back with four other people. When they landed in New York, everybody had passed away from disease except for Minnick, and he became property of the museum at that point. There was a lot of racism and tokenism, people paying the museum to see him. He has a very difficult history, but it's actually kind of a common theme with Indigenous collections and museums that people don't really know about. And this kayak kind of tells that story. He ended up going back to Greenland, but he didn't know his language and he didn't know how to hunt, so he didn't really fit in well. Came back to New York and then died of the Spanish flu in 1918. So this is a more difficult story that kind of tells a history of collecting in a way that people might not be familiar with in Canada or across North America. And so we've been working with people in Kanak, Greenland, to learn what this kayak might mean to them. And then maybe in the future talking about it going home. The other thing about taking objects out of community is the knowledge that comes with that. Having kayaks removed, the knowledge to know how to construct them and build them. So I think in some cases it might be important that some of the boats go back home. There's so many different stories for each watercraft, but I think one of the most important messages for me is just our tie to the natural environment, our reliance on it, but also our impact on it, and how the canoe teaches us how to travel untraceable. And I think in some ways we need to go back to that, but it's really cool to see the relationships across Turtle Island and the world, and how the canoe isn't distinct to Canadian culture. There was a long history before Canada even existed with the canoe, and there's a long history around the world of people using the canoe to connect and to rely on the environment. And I think it also teaches us about reciprocity a little bit. Harvesting birch bark canoe construction in particular, which I've kind of taken an interest in and helped out with a couple different builds, like offering tobacco or sema before harvesting, and like just being respectful and thankful, and giving those natural materials new life by making them into a canoe is kind of cool. But I hear like similar teachings, you know, in New Chaloneuth cultures from Giselle Martin talking about her stewardship with the land and how it's a give and take, and it's not about greed. It's about being thankful and respectful and reciprocal, and making sure that in generations people will also still have the materials they need to build canoes and connect. Going back to like the devastation that we're witnessing on our natural environment, if people don't have something to connect with, then they don't have something to care with. And I feel like the canoe kind of provides a lens to care. And yeah, connect people and stories. And the Canoe Museum has been a beautiful place to also talk about some more contemporary stories. Indigenous people still exist. And in a lot of museums, it's like we're dinosaurs. So it's good to be able to connect with different people and cultures and tell stories.
Mary Jane Prue is Anishinaabe and Scottish. She is the Indigenous Projects Coordinator at the Canadian Canoe Museum in Peterborough, Ontario. You're listening to Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, US Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. A couple summers ago, Ian McCallum put a canoe in the Thames River for the first time. But he was looking to do more than just paddle in Ontario. He wanted to see the river through the eyes of his ancestors. And he hoped the two-day canoe journey would help to revitalize the Lenape language.
Yokwa, yape, asiskawap. Let's go down by the river. Yonkwa kishkwik alame amcho ndapalika. On this day, I step upon the boat. Kilona kapahamahina ekwi tayakwanal wak esh kishapela. We paddle under bridges and through rapids. Tayakwanung nekawa wendamawak kweka nekawa pitahewak. At the bridge, they fish with a line. What did they catch? Wasingwa, Changamekwish, Wishaposhamek, Hualamek, Wishakmek, Kinhokwis, Wisamek, Pickerel, small fish, shiner, mullet, eel, pike, catfish.
That's Ian, reading from his book, Canoe Trip on the Thames. It's written in Munsee, a Lenape dialect, and in English. He says paddling and cultural revitalization go hand in hand. Ian is a language educator and a member of the Munsee Delaware Nation. Welcome to Unreserved.
Thank you, Rosanna.
There are so many places to go canoeing in Ontario. What's special about the Thames River for you?
It comes back to I never actually got a chance to paddle a river as a young child or as a young adult. So now as a middle-aged adult, I'm finding the ability to decompress and get away from the 9-to-5 by going out on the Thames River and taking that time to explore and slow down a bit and look at the world around the Thames River in a more critical eye in terms of understanding exactly what my ancestors saw and, you know, and what we can learn today and share with future generations.
We heard a little bit of your book, and it was written in Munsee and English. Why was that important to you?
Well, the goal is to sort of support our language work on the reserve. So we work with a fairly vibrant adult class. But we also wanted to prepare a work that would, engage the younger students as well. So we wanted to make sure that our students who are in elementary school in the local school board would have access to language learning materials as well.
Mm. You mentioned that you wanted to see and connect with your ancestors and see what they saw. How does canoeing on the Thames connect you to your ancestors?
Well, the Munsee people came to Ontario in the early 1780s. They were refugees from the American Revolution after leaving their homelands in New Jersey and Pennsylvania. So rivers tended to be fairly important to us in terms of ways to travel westward towards the Ohio country and as well on to the northwest towards the Niagara. So rivers sort of played a vital importance for us in terms of travel. And I sort of wanted to understand why we decided to settle on the Thames River and the Grand River as opposed to other places in Ontario.
And what did you learn about Lenape history and culture on that first trip?
It was designed to support Canadian historical educators that were gathering at the University of Western Ontario. The pandemic canceled that. However, there were four of us who decided to go out in the river. I'm an academic from Huron College and two other community members, former Chief Mark Peters and his son and myself. So one of the goals was to learn a lot from Mark because he's the community historian. And along the river, he shared important treaty pieces, where our people had our cornfields, where there was potential conflict with new settlers and loyalists that came to Upper Canada. And so from my standpoint, it was a great opportunity to actually have 2 days where I could listen to our historian, but also to take a look around where, how did we use the river? And Mark pointed out the potential for, fish weirs. I went over shoals of giant clams. But I also got to see a lot of the trees along the river, too, as well, like giant sycamore trees that don't necessarily grow anywhere else in Ontario. So I got, getting to think in terms of language. And if I go into the Lenape language or the Munsee language for the sycamore, the English translation works into boat tree. So it gives a clue as to what the Munsee, the Lenape people used the tree for. Hmm.
Of course, Ontario isn't the traditional territory of the Munsee Delaware Nation. Where is your community's traditional territory?
So we're the Munsee people of the Lenape group of people, our homelands are in New York, Pennsylvania, New Jersey. So along the Hudson River, along the Delaware River, anywhere from basically New York City all the way to Philadelphia.
And how similar is Thames and the Ontario landscape to, you know, that traditional territories in New York and New Jersey?
That's a great question. That's one that I'm trying to learn more about because of, recent canoe trips on, smaller rivers in New Jersey. I found that the plants and the tree species are very much the same, as well as, the flat land that surrounds those rivers. And I'm trying to sort of, I don't know if it's build a case, but sort of get a better understanding as to where the Munsee, the Lenape people settled on their ways northwest and west when they got pushed out, that it wasn't exactly a mistake. Like they knew where they were settling and there was a reason for why they chose to settle where they did.
Mm. How have people responded to the book?
So it's been well received. I think it's sort of prompted a greater interest in the community to want to access the Thames or at least to chat about things. And that's one of the big things that we have in our monthly language classes is that we teach some language, but we also share a lot of the history and culture, and it sort of stimulates conversation amongst the elders and other community members. Oh, you know what? Next time you're down, let's go out on the river together. You can show me some things. Or, some of the elders have stories of their own with regard to the river or things that happen in the community that they want to share.
Hmm. I understand, as you said, you've been bringing community members canoeing. What kind of teachings do you do when you take people paddling on the river?
So in the past, we've sort of spread out maps of the region. And to be honest with you, I didn't think that the maps would be a hit. And so we brought those out at lunchtime. So we were able to show, where the villages were on the Thames and in relation to other Indigenous communities, but also the beginning of European settlement. And some of the other teachings that I do out there would be the seasonal practices of my community, going out to the maple sugar forest, accessing Lake Erie for fish, and then also where their summer fields were for their planting. So that whole cyclical nature of the Lenape people, the Munsee people on the Thames, I sort of share that. And, the importance of the actual ability to transport your access corn, your access maple sugar to Detroit, because they sold quite a bit there. But they also supported another Lenape group that came up and settled on the Thames in 1791 with access food.
Why is it important for you to, to share this history and this culture and, go along the Thames and say, that's where we did this and this is what happened here?
As you find information and as a language speaker, I think that history and culture are intertwined. It's important to share because, of course, I had access to that as a young person back in the 70s, where I had that generation that was born in the 1800s, the late 1800s, who would share with me. And I think it's one of our, I hate to say it's a duty or it's a job, but it's a job well taken that you're supposed to share that knowledge on with other generations, but also sort of spur that interest in being proud of who you are.
Are there specific words that show how language is connected to this land in particular?
Yeah, part of the research that I've done looks at place names, and there's a particular place name that was assigned to the city of Hamilton here in Ontario, and it was assigned by the Delaware speakers, the Munsee speakers at Six Nations, and that word is Alamawang, which means down the hill. And if you've ever been in Hamilton, in the old days, Hamilton was at the base of the Niagara Escarpment. And since then, it's grown to the top of the escarpment. But it's one of those perfect geographical names that we've given a place that adequately describe it.
How does this, this land-based learning, or as the case may be, water-based learning, how does it help language revitalization?
I think prior to to me, going out onto the Thames, and it's not revolutionary. There's lots of great language people that have done some work on the rivers in northern Ontario. I think if we have the ability to learn a whole lot more about our people by taking a paddle or considering the river, simply because those resources aren't readily accessible. So, you know, when our kids go to school, they don't have access to, let's say, wide swaths of nature, right? You're dealing with a school playground. And it's the ability just to take the time and slow down. So many of us can't slow down and disconnect from our electronic devices. But when you're on the river, you get that sense that you're somewhere else because of it almost seems secluded. Even though southwestern Ontario is not a secluded place, it's very, built up and there's lots of agriculture. When you're out on that river, you get that sense that you could be somewhere else in Canada that's far away from civilization.
Another time and place, you might say.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Do you find that people learn, absorb, connect more with the language when they're, paddling on the river?
Yeah, I think so. And I think, talking about it on dry land, I guess, as well, I found that access, people accessing the language class, we have a lot more people coming out that want to, they want to plan something to go out on the river, but they also just want to talk about, river history and our community as a whole. So I kind of feel like the river was a catalyst for having these discussions sort of in a wider range. And of course, people are always saying, well, let's go paddle some rivers in Pennsylvania, like the Susquehanna or the Juniata. Let's go paddle some rivers in New Jersey. And it's maybe that, I don't know if it's that sovereignty piece, but wanting to learn more and sort of paddle in the, in the wake of our ancestors. Maybe, I don't know if that's a good term or not. Because they were going real fast. We're not.
That's right. Sort of surfing
That's
in the
right.
wig, maybe.
Exactly.
What is your hope for this work?
So my hope for this work is not just language, but, to sort of build on the history that we have of our community. I would like to we've already published a list of Muncie place names in southwestern Ontario with the help of the University of Western Ontario. We have also started a comprehensive list of trees and plants, animals, insects that are along the Thames, and trying to find those words. And that takes us back to, far-reaching places such as Harvard University, because there's a whole list of Muncie language documents written there. Takes us to the Smithsonian in Washington and New York City to try and find those missing names for plants and trees that don't necessarily, appear in our dictionary. It's that whole digging and sleuthing.
And so is the hope then to sort of return that those words, those names, and have your people's presence acknowledged in that area ultimately?
Yeah, and I think to have those resources available too for language learners. I think that, a lot of other Indigenous communities in Canada and the United States have sort of done that work as well. I think it's the Lac des Milnes Ojibwe from Wisconsin have created a poster of their trees that are there. And I think that that'd be a wonderful resource in this day and age to have, both the visual copy, but also the ability to interact with that that poster or that map so that future generations can hear and see the language.
Ian, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, Nishik.
Ian McCallum is a language educator and a member of the Muncie Delaware Nation. You're listening to Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Today, canoeing as connection to Indigenous history, language, and healing. Florent Volant is Innu from Malio-Tanam, Quebec. He is one half of the iconic music duo Cashtin. Here he is with his song, Boat on the River.
Take me back to my boat on the river. I need to go down. I need to come down. as I gaze in the water, it eases me down, touching me gently. The waters that flow as my boat on the river, so I don't cry out anymore. Oh, the river is wise, the river, it touches my life like the waves on the sand. Long roads lead to tranquility base, when the frown on my face disappears.
Boat on the River. You're listening to Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Today, canoeing as connection to Indigenous history, language, and healing. Every summer, hundreds of canoes gather along the coast of the Pacific Northwest. This awesome sight is known as tribal canoe journeys. Coastal canoe families paddle to host communities. Some spend weeks on the water. Paddlers share songs, dances, stories, and teachings. For decades, these journeys have helped communities reconnect with their cultural traditions and heal from intergenerational traumas caused by residential schools, the potlatch bans, and other assimilation policies. Michelle Robinson witnessed her first tribal canoe journey about 20 years ago. A few years later, her whole family joined the journey, and she's been involved ever since. Now she helps get more people out paddling through an organization called All Nations Paddles Up. Michelle is from Klahoos and Shemaynuch Nations and is married into the Ahauzit Nation.
I believe it was 1999, the year that my husband's tribe, Ahauzit First Nation, hosted. And they're on an island in a quite compacted community. And the front beach is a big sand beach. And then to see all the canoes just come around the corner, come around the point and just kind of all line up a bit off the beach. And they're all lined up and they're waiting their turn to get protocol to ask permission to come ashore, which is the honorable and respectable thing to do, is to ask permission to step onto someone else's territory and graciously ask them to host you. And so it was something I had never experienced, but to see this, just all these canoes, people wearing regalia, the community wearing the regalia on the beach and singing, the dancing, the welcoming, just to see the elders. I seen my husband's grandmother just beaming with pride, have tears in her eyes just to see this and witness it. You could see the impact it had on their spirit, and to see Ahauzit with a lot of pride share their culture, welcoming the canoes ashore, it was powerful. As a kid, I did some training with some friends in the Coast Salish traditional canoes, and I just loved it. I really loved it. And so we would train every day with my friends from the Sonoma community. And because I loved it so much, I was like, after school, I would be not doing my schoolwork. And my mom was like, you can't practice for canoe pulling anymore because you're avoiding your school. So I had to stop. And so it really just kind of broke my heart, but I understood where my mom was coming from. So it just stayed with me for so many years. And then, you know, hearing all the stories of my aunties and my mom, like they had all their stories about canoe pulling when they're young. And I just felt I really needed to do it when the time came for the 2005 Lower Awa paddle. I was like, okay, I'm not gonna not pull. I have to do this. And so it was something that was just right in me. And so 2005 came along, and so we left actually from a house. It was a powerful thing too, because there was at that time there was I don't even remember the numbers. It was like it was a horrible amount of numbers that were, you know, youth were attempting suicide, and some had passed on because of that. And there it was just like they were calling it an epidemic. We really wanted to start from the community of a house because they were really going through that. And so we had these young people that felt that they wanted to leave this world. And we're like, no, you have to come paddle with us. And the whole community wanted to really instill it in them that they weren't alone. So the whole community came out, and literally they put the young people in the canoe, and the whole community lifted this 46-foot canoe, cedar canoe, that was hundreds of pounds, and lifted them up and packed them into water. And they just, you'll never be alone. And so that really, I just really felt like I wanted to be a part of that, and to share, like, you know, that I am there with them. I just wanted to show that I supported them, I guess. That was kind of like where my heart was starting from. We started off really bright and sunny, and then we left to house it. And I wasn't expecting it to be that long of a pull that day, but we were paddling to Ucuilut. So we went from a house at First Nation to Ucuilut. And it's a 12-hour pull, and it was nice and sunny. Then we hit the fog, and you're out on these big swells, and our canoe was big, but you would go up and then you would just disappear into these these big waves, and you wouldn't see our support boat because a support boat follows you. We need a support boat too for safety reasons and to switch off and crew off the canoe and onto the boat and back and forth just to give people rests. And so we did a 12-hour paddle on the west coast of the island, and there's nothing like it. And we just made our way all the way down the west coast of Vancouver Island, and then crossed over from Victoria to Port Angeles, and then down into Lower Elwha onto their reserve, and they welcomed us. There was, I believe, there was probably around 100, over 100 canoes that year that traveled that far from all different parts. It's not just getting on the canoe. There's a lot of teachings. So the teachings that I was given, being told to be respectful to the canoe because it's alive and it has a spirit, right? And so that to me was a real honor to be able to pass that on. There was a lot of young people that had never been on the canoe before. And for a lot of our people that are survivors, residential school survivors, that have intergenerational trauma, just all these things that encompass colonialism, and it's compacted. And so you see everybody that's different upbringings and different things going on, and then all of a sudden you're on a canoe. And so having to learn to paddle together is really, really important. There was challenges for us, but you know, to give them the teachings that, you know, every time you put your paddle in the water, and if you're having a hard day, don't be afraid to cry and leave your tears in the water and hand it over to the ancestors and let the spirit of the canoe help you with that, right? And you have to pray to the canoe and the spirit of the tree and the canoe to help you with that. So with every stroke, you know, you're telling them, just if you have to cry, if you have to stop and cry, do it. You know, when you can, put that paddle back in the water. And some people will cry through the paddles. We had people with addictions, and we had so many different things that just to see what the paddle does, what the water does, what the ocean does, you know, to be surrounded by whales and, you know, sea life, and it's such a healing thing. And even if you're not going through something, to be a part of it and to put your hand to it and to be a help, to share your teachings, because everybody has something to contribute. And to do that, it's healing for you regardless of wherever you're at in your journey. And so it just brings tears to your eyes just to see where everybody's at, and to see what it's doing for yourself. Yeah, it's beautiful. In 2015, my nation, I went to work for Clahoos First Nation, my dad's people, and I wanted my dad's nation to experience the canoe journey and what it does for you. I wanted to bring that to them. I had to wake that up, and I had to make sure that that happened in my community. So I just couldn't let it go. And so I was like, how can I wake this up? How can I present this to the community in a gentle way, where instead of just like throwing it on them, because I didn't want to like freak them out and they would like, I'm not doing that. So I started having culture night once a week. So one of the first things I did was I did a drum workshop, and they were like, well, what are we going to do with these? And I was like, yes, exactly. So how about we make some songs? And so I asked them, what kind of songs would you like? And that's when they said, we want a paddle song. A lot of us had never done it, but I had talked to a lot of singers and a lot of our elders and Coast Salish communities, you know, plus my own family, my grandmother. You know, she had the memories, like, and my dad. Then we had my cousin Drew Blaney from Thlamen come over, and then we gathered all the elders and our language speakers, and we created songs. It was powerful. And so then we did that, and then I was like, okay, well, how about a paddle? How about we have somebody come over and do a paddle workshop? And so now we have these paddles, and they're like, what are we going to do with them? Exactly. So how about we get a canoe and we go on the canoe journeys? And so that's how we got to, we're going on the canoe journeys. We have, you know, some songs, we have paddles. And so we started fundraising. So we were able to purchase our canoe at the beginning of 2017. And that was the first year we participated and made our way to our first canoe journey and for Clahoos First Nation. In 2018, there's a group of us that had gotten together. We got together and we said, you know, we want to do something throughout the rest of the year to create these moments. We won't be able to do these, you know, 3-week journeys, but if we can create these small little pockets of paddles, because our people need it. This community you create traveling from place to place to get to your host. But then once you get there, now you're a part of this community of 100 canoes and thousands of people. And then you go home. It's hard for people, especially with addictions and, you know, that, you know, have that feeling that they need to take their own life. And, you know, there's, because of all these intergenerational traumas that happen, and you go home and you're alone, and you go back to your addiction fight to, you know, to lose your addiction and all these different things. And so we wanted to create something, little smaller mini versions to the journeys, weekends. You know, we like them on the weekends because people have to go home, go to work, and go to school. And so it pushed us to create these little weekends of paddles. We named it All Nations Paddle Up. And there's a group of us, beautiful people, all are volunteer. They volunteer their time and their efforts. There's a lot of families that are in nations that have canoes, and it's a lot of money to take your group for weeks. It costs thousands of dollars to get that canoe on the water. And everybody fundraises for that. Like, people have to fundraise thousands of dollars to make it happen. because you have to pay for your fuel, you have to pay for your support boat, you have to pay for the food, supplies, life jackets, safety equipment, paddles. It's a big endeavor, and it's a huge thing for anybody to undertake, any community to do that. But when you have one family that's, you know, they're struggling to get their canoe on the water, so, and then they only have room for, say, 10 people or 15 people. And so there's a lot of people that get left behind. And so that's where All Nations Come Aboard is. They're like, it's for anybody. It's for everybody and anybody that wants to come aboard and experience that and get some healing, to touch the water, to, you know, just be a part of it and just to experience it. And we wanted to just catch the people that want to continue that once they're done with the big canoe journey that happens once a year, and for people that get missed out when canoes leave home normally, and for people that can't make those 3-week, 2-week long journeys, they can come and participate in the weekend ones. So we like to fundraise and make sure these things happen. And we, as All Nations Paddle Up, just want to offer that to people. We want to be able to make sure it's open arms. We only ask that people come and be, you know, drug and alcohol free, that they come and they, you know, just be open to what the ancestors have to give you, to be open to become part of that little community for that time being. And you're always a part of the family once you step off the canoe, and you're always welcome back.
Michelle is from Clahoose and Chemainach Nations and is married into the Ahauzit Nation. As a volunteer, she helps run All Nations Paddles Up. Last week, Unreserved celebrated a very special milestone. We turned 10 years old. To mark the occasion, we threw an anniversary extravaganza. The party was recorded live at Winnipeg's Park Theatre. Everyone was there. Comic Sherry McKay, DJ Doozy, Elder Barbara Nepinak, and an Anti-Circle 2.0. Don't worry, though. You're still invited. Unreserved Turns 10 will air in this radio space on June 23rd. Here's a sneaky preview. Sherry McKay is Anishinaabe Kwe from Treaty 1 territory. She is a comedian, writer, social media content creator, and a mom. Put your hands together for Miss Sherry McKay. So this is not new for you, but how does it feel to, you know, perform in front of such an enthusiastic crowd?
It feels really good. Yeah, it feels really good. It fills the spirit, and the fact that I know that I made a few people, you know, feel good and have some laughs, because there's so much seriousness in the world, and I think that's what we need is some laughter.
Mm, yeah. What originally drew you to comedy and wanting to be a stand-up comic and a TikToker and all that so funny stuff you do?
My aunties and my uncles, you know, growing up, we grew up poor. So a lot of times they would literally like do stand up. So it wasn't so much stand up as glorified storytelling. Mm. But they would always tell the same stories, and they were always funny. And it didn't matter how many times I heard the same story and over and over again, it would be like, uncle, tell that story again, you know, tell it for my friends. And so they would literally get up and perform these funny stories that were all derived from truth and experience, right? And so that's what I do, is I talk a lot about my own experiences.
Yeah. I remember that, going back to the res, and then, you know, an uncle would tell a story, and then the next uncle would add on to that story, and then the cousin would add to the, and then by the time that they finished telling that particular hunting story, the moose's antlers are biz big. Why do you think humor shows up so much in our storytelling as Indigenous people?
I think it probably started with, you know, dealing with some traumas and maybe not making light of a situation, but just making it real and normalizing it for a lot of our people. Because sometimes we think we're so alone in certain things that when you talk about those things, you know, a lot of times people are going to relate and they're going to have their own stories. And then that's when you get the big antlers, you know, mm-hmm. That's when people are adding on to stuff, and then you don't feel so alone. And I feel like it's definitely, you know, come from trauma. Plus, we're just real funny people.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. We're not stoic and crying all the time.
No, just that one time.
Just that one time. Don't forget, Unreserved turns 10. That's like 100 ResDoc years. It airs on June 23rd. Tune into the party and bring your cousins. That's all our time on Radio Indigenous. This episode was produced by Kim Kasher, Rhiannon Johnson, Zoe Tennant, and Elena Hudgens-Lyle. You can now listen to us streaming live on the CBC News app. Just go to the local tab and press play wherever you are. You can also find and follow us wherever you get your podcasts. I'm your favorite cousin, Rosanna Deerchild. We're going to leave you with one more song. This is Kim Gucci with Territory Welcome Song.
We welcome you to Claidly Tenekeo. Together we'll stand to honor the land, hand in hand, on Claidly Tenekeo. It's a beautiful day, it's a whale.